When the Civil War is viewed through the rearview mirror of history, one thing we take for granted is the solidarity of the White South as a united block of support of the Confederacy and the Southern way of life. But according to our guest this morning, there were pockets of Southern Unionists who resisted, who continue to influence the face of our country today. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickard, and I'm glad to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we continue Civil War Week here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Victoria Bynum. She's the author of The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Descent and Its Legacies. She taught history at Texas State University, San Marcos, and she's also the author of The Free State of Jones and Unruly Women. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning. How does Southern Unionism change the Civil War story? And what have you heard about the Southern resistance to the Confederacy? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And we'd also love to have you along on Facebook. You'll find a link at wpr.org. And Victoria Bynum, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's Civil War Week here on Wisconsin Public Radio, as you may know, and the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War. And you, by nature of your vocation, you have a deeper grasp on this than most of us. What does the 150th anniversary mean to you?
Well, it means to me just how long we really have been fighting this Civil War. It's sometimes amazing to consider the amount of emotion and disagreement that can still be generated in just an ordinary conversation about the Civil War. Being someone who looks at Southern Unionists, I experience that maybe a little more frequently than other Civil War historians, but it's really widespread.
Is there an inclination to deny the history of Southern Unionists when you get to the South?
Yes, I think there still is. Mostly it's not even being aware that they were there. And then when there is an awareness of them, and I think of this especially in regard to Newt Knight and the Free State of Jones, there's often an effort to just dismiss them and denigrate them as treasonous, ignorant, poor whites, that sort of thing. So when they can't be denied, they're often denigrated.
What does it mean to you to have uncovered this vein of research about Southern Unionists?
Well, it really has occupied me as a historian now for over 20 years. I didn't start off being a historian of Southern Unionism. I actually was going to look at women and free blacks in the antebellum South and then take it into the Civil War. And along the way, I discovered white Southern Unionists to whom women and free blacks also had, you know, oftentimes connections, historical connections. And so the story just got broader for me and much more complex and interesting.
It does come as a bit of a shock when you hear about it because you don't often hear stories like that coming out of the South. It seems as though there's kind of a black and white just narrative about Southern links to the Confederacy and the Civil War in general. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that the Civil War was so thoroughly written according to first of all, it was written according to the victors, the North, and you got an abolitionist view that portrayed the South as a land of slaveholders and slaves. And then you got a new version that's it's often referred to as the myth of the lost cause, which brought a whole new version of the Civil War that said that, well, the war really wasn't about slavery at all. It was a noble cause, a constitutional battle simply over states' rights, and so slavery sort of got written out. And so both versions of the Civil War were very simplistic and very much morality plays, depending on which side was telling the moral of the story. Hmm. And the story is really so much more complex than that.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing. And do you think that we've uncovered a lot of it now about the truth of what actually happened and the nuance there? Or do you think it's just the tip of the iceberg?
Well, I think we have uncovered a lot. I think historians have been working on this for decades. And I think the major task, though, is to get it into more of the mainstream reading lists, to get it into the popular histories, to get it into the textbooks. And so I think that a lot of history has been done and more is certainly waiting to be done, but that a simultaneous task is to get it into the consciousness, into the popular consciousness. And I think that's begun as well to happen.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of what we mean when we talk about Southern Unionism?
Sure. Well, one of the reasons why in The Long Shadow of the Civil War I didn't write a third monographic study of just a particular area is that I wanted to really emphasize how widespread these pockets of resistance to the Confederacy were throughout the South. And it's I don't want to exaggerate it by saying that, this inner Civil War took place throughout the South. But as you pointed out in your introduction, there are pockets of resistance that resulted in inner civil wars throughout the South, and in every Confederate state there were these battles. And so they really need to be known about because they tell us so much more about the potential of the South and also the legacy of the Civil War, the long legacy of the Civil War.
Well, one of the figures that you write about in your book is a man by the name of Newt Knight, and he continues to be polarizing to this day. Can you tell us some of his story?
Yes. Newt Knight was really a rather, at least on the surface, ordinary yeoman farmer before the Civil War. His grandfather was one of the largest slaveholders of Jones County, but his father and himself were not slaveholders, chose not to be slaveholders. And when the war began, they were opposed to secession, as a good many Southerners were. And most of the voters in Jones County, where Newt Knight was from, voted for a delegate to the Mississippi Convention who was against secession, a cooperationist candidate, only going to vote for secession under certain conditions. So there was not a lot of enthusiasm for secession in this part of Mississippi, and the surrounding counties as well had strong anti-secession votes. So Newt Knight is part of this. He's not the leader of some sort of movement towards secession or against secession. He's part of this movement. But Newt Knight changes throughout the war. He becomes more and more militant. At first, he joins the Confederacy in hopes that we would think that the war would be over soon. But then he deserts the Confederacy twice, and he becomes the elected captain of a band of deserters that then arm themselves and fight against the Confederacy from Jones County, which is in the Piney Woods southeastern section of Mississippi, and they fight against the Confederacy for over 2 years.
And they basically took over the county, didn't they?
They did. They did. The county, the government broke down in the county, the government structure, and the leader of one of the militia groups empowered to arrest deserters was shot in the home of the Confederate representative, Amos Deason, and he was, it's pretty certain, shot by Newt Knight and some of his accomplices. And there were a number of murders back and forth. It was a very, very bloody inner civil war there in Jones County.
One thing that's interesting about Newt Knight is that he's one of this handful of Southern Unionists whose children decided to write biographies about them, and his son, in fact, is still trying to reclaim what he thinks Newt Knight lost in terms of a face for the family.
That's right. His son, Tom Knight, who died in the 1950s, he was a very old man, but he wrote a biography in the 1930s, and then he published it in the 1940s, and always trying to defend his father as a true Unionist, not simply an outlaw or a bandit, as Newt Knight is often characterized by those who still revere the Confederacy. He's been presented as an outlaw, as just low class, ignorant, that sort of thing. And Tom Knight worked very, very hard to show his father's political views, to present him as a hero of the people. He even romanticized his father, and the one thing that he left out of his account of his father is the interracial relationships that Newt Knight had, and the children that Newt Knight fathered by a former slave woman, and then more children by her daughter. So that was the part of the story that Newt Knight didn't want to tell. He wanted to tell a much more sanitized version of Newt Knight.
You said that this part of Mississippi was sympathetic with the Unionists. Why would that be?
This is an area primarily of non-slaveholders. This is not part of the Cotton Belt. Now, I still want to emphasize that there are slaveholders there, and they have the greater share of the political power. They are the elites of the area. But they're pretty few in number. I mean, there were fewer than – there were only not many more than 10 that owned more than 20 slaves. On the eve of the Civil War. So there's a lot of what we call yeoman farmers, non-slaveholders. And while many of them still managed to be enthusiastic for secession and did join the Confederacy, many more of them, as I said earlier, opposed secession. And while they grudgingly joined Confederate unions or units after being conscripted, they were quick to desert by late 1862, many of the non-slaveholders who had joined the Confederate Army upon conscription, they were deserting, and those numbers only became larger until after Vicksburg. Many of them were just absolutely refused to go back, and they joined at that point Newt Knight's band called the Knight Company in deference to his being the captain of it.
And that Knight Company sort of spawned other branches that became active in other states, didn't it?
It does. I would say parallels rather than spawns them. But there were many other bands. One of them that I write about in The Long Shadow of the Civil War that was equally, in fact, perhaps more ferocious was the Owens Band in the Quaker Belt of North Carolina. And it's named after its leader, Bill Owens. There were a number of these guerrilla bands throughout the South, and most of them began to emerge in late 1862, sometimes a little later than that, as the war dragged on, as people inched closer and closer towards starvation, maybe plunged toward starvation is a better word. And this is the reason why they also involved on the home front. I mean, it wasn't just guerrilla bands roaming the countryside. These were also community wars. Women were involved. Children were involved at whatever levels were demanded of them. Women often hiding men in the woods. Children often doing the same, trying to, you know, sneak out and feed them and hold off the Confederacy when they came in to try to find them, and sometimes themselves finding themselves in danger of being arrested or even being shot in some cases.
Yeah, it's so interesting, this other culture in the South that emerges through these stories that you tell in your book about bands of men who are hiding out in the woods and the women who are trying to protect them and who are really fighting off tax collectors and others who are trying to enforce enlistment and coming around and sometimes brutalizing these people as well.
Exactly, yes. And in the North Carolina Quaker Belt, you also have the element of religious opposition to slavery, not so much from the Quakers who had, you know, most of the Quakers who really believed strongly that slavery needed to end had migrated on up into Illinois and Indiana. But the Wesleyan Methodists had begun to emerge in the late 1840s in the Northeast, and they had moved on down into North Carolina. And so there was a Wesleyan Methodist community in Randolph County area that also lent a lot of force to the resistance to the Confederacy, and by nature involved women more directly as well, since women were considered just, you know, the heart of religious activity and religious devotion during that period of time. So that also drew women even more centrally into this conflict.
Could you tell us some of their stories, especially that chapter on women had so many unexpected tales that I think they're worth hearing now?
Yes, that chapter, I had first introduced that topic in Unruly Women, and as I continued to research it, I learned so much more that I returned to it and really expanded it. My favorite character is Martha Sheets. She is this woman who, toward the war is really almost over, and she wrote a letter to the sheriff and signed her name to it, just telling him that if he didn't get grain to her door, she was going to sic the deserters on him. And it was clear that she had access to deserters. And she just, called him every name in the book for keeping his sons out of the war. And while her husband and her sons were off in the war, and ended it by just saying, and make that good grain, deliver that good grain. Probably the most poignant story and heartbreaking story, however, is the story of the Hewlands, who were the neighbors of Martha Sheets and were probably distant kin. And these are all part of the Wesleyan Methodist community that I talked about. But there are letters to the governor from two sisters who were related, one of them by marriage and the other an in-law, of three of these brothers, Jesse, John, and William Hewland, who were Wesleyan Methodists who refused to join the Confederacy, who deserted at the first chance or refused to join it. And they were – by late in the war, they were finally rounded up and executed. Mm-hmm. But before they were executed, vigilante style, these women, their female kin, had written these letters to the governor, just trying to tell the governor what was going on in their county, trying to defend unionism as a principal position. And the letter that probably is the most detailed and complex is the one from Phoebe Crook, who was the sister-in-law of the three Hewland brothers, where she defended it all in terms of Republican ideals and rights of citizenship. What she was pinpointing was the abuse by Confederate militia and Home Guard soldiers. She claimed that they were simply arming themselves and murdering the citizens and using their positions as a way to stay out of the war themselves. It's quite a moving letter.
That recasts women during the Civil War as just sort of victims who are hanging on. It sounds like these women are trying to take an active part in the story that's unfolding around them and also having some intellectual heft to what they're doing and what they're thinking about.
Exactly. That's an important point that I make in the book, is that these are not just soldiers' wives and victims. They are certainly that, but they are also – they are unionists themselves, and they have a sense of their own rights of citizenship and their own responsibilities of citizenship, at least in those cases of Martha Sheets and Phoebe Crooks.
Our guest this hour is Victoria Bynum. She's the author of The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Descent and Its Legacies. She's taught history at Texas State University, San Marcos, and is also the author of The Free State of Jones and Unruly Women. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this morning as Wisconsin Public Radio observes Civil War Week. How does Southern Unionism change the Civil War story as you know it? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And want to make you aware that coming up at 10 o'clock, it's an NPR News special. It's live coverage of the final launch of the space shuttle as Atlantis makes one more supply run to the International Space Station. Join Neil Conan for this momentous event as NASA's storied program prepares for its last liftoff. That's an NPR News special, the final launch of the space shuttle, coming up at 10 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this Friday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this morning is Victoria Bynum. She's the author of The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Descent and Its Legacies. And we're talking about what these news stories, these revelations we're hearing about this morning about Southern Unionism, how that changes the Civil War story, and why it is we haven't heard stories like this very often. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. And we take our first caller now. We go to Art joining us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Art.
Hi. Thanks very much for your work. I've got a few thoughts if I could share them. First, a number of years ago, I read a book of essays by Herbert Apthecker, including several chapters specifically on the average poor working white person in the South and how they really didn't have any interest in any material or objective interest in defending slavery, and that many of them realized that and didn't support it, and that was much underreported. And he was encouraging future historians to do much more work in this area, as well as his much later book in Abolitionism, where he did the same thing. So I'm very glad to hear more about that. If I can draw a possible parallel that you might want to comment on, today we have in Wisconsin, for example, some of us think that there's a relatively small minority that's very well-heeled, that is sort of setting a political agenda, and lots of folks who we do not see as having an objective stake in these so-called reforms, taking away collective bargaining, etc. But a lot of people seem to be following that because of the media or whatever, the culturization. And I think to some degree that was going on in the South, where there was a small minority of rich slaveholders that wanted to get a lot of other white folk to fight for them, and to some degree did, and to some degree, as your work shows, did not. The other area I'd just like you to comment on is what, if anything, you know about the role of German Americans in Wisconsin. They were very strong in terms of the pro-union cause, and we know that they, and particularly the Turners, who were kind of an athletic group, came from the 1848 revolution period in Germany to the U.S., were instrumental in Missouri and in Maryland and probably in Kentucky in preventing those states from joining the Confederacy. But I know there were also significant German-American communities in Texas, for example, and perhaps you know something about that or would like to add anything regarding those contributions.
Okay, thank you, Art. Victoria Bynum?
Yes. Art brings up two very important points about Southern Unionism, and I'll take the second one first, just because it's having taught in Texas, I actually had even a student who wrote a master's thesis on the German-Texan opposition to the Confederacy, to secession in the Confederacy. And there are several extremely important German communities around Comfort and Sisterdale that were directly related to the revolutions and the immigrants coming from the European revolutions to Texas. And they suffered some of the most horrific inner civil wars because of their opposition to secession. So, yes, German Texans were extremely important to the anti-Confederate sentiment in the state of Texas, very much so. And then in general, the comparison that Art was making to today's world with the particularly going on in Wisconsin, I know, but in other states as well, with the sense of great wealth and just a lack of any interest in the needs of average working people. I do think there's a parallel there. I'm often struck by it. I think that white Southerners had more class consciousness, certainly elevated by the Civil War itself and what it meant to their lives, than has often been recognized. And Newt Knight's class consciousness, my argument is, grew over time and, in fact, continued to grow after the Civil War because he remained politically active. And in the 1890s, he actually said that he then believed that the non-slaveholders should have risen up and just overthrown the slaveholding class altogether. In hindsight, that's what he saw. He said, rather than being tricked into fighting their war, as so many of them were.
Oh, that's so interesting. Why do you think then that the South had this more well-defined class consciousness than the North? What do you think the ingredients were there?
I'm not sure if I understood you. I don't think they had a better developed class consciousness than the North. I think it was expressed differently. I mean, I think in the North you certainly had a working class consciousness that growing up since, you know, well into the, you know, back into the 1830s and forward. And as many historians have argued, you don't really find a similar thing among Southerners. In fact, they often point to a lack of class consciousness among Southerners. And I think it's less on the surface, but I think the resentments are there. there, often not articulated by Southern farmers who oftentimes were not even literate and didn't have labor unions the way that the Northeast had developed. But I think that the Civil War not only deepens their sense of class consciousness but begins to give them a voice. And so I see a more defined class consciousness coming later to the South, at least in terms of its articulation.
Okay.
And it really reaches its full flowering in the late 19th century with the populist movement, the People's Party, and even something that people don't often associate with the South, but a socialist party. And I found that my unionists from both Jones County and some of them in Texas, and I don't want to exaggerate this is a small but still significant a number of them who they and their descendants did join the Populist Party and the Socialist Party, something you don't often think of as existing in Piney Woods, Mississippi,
right,
or Texas. But it did.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Art. And we'll move on now to David joining us from Waukesha. Hi, David.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the wonderful guest and her work. Two quick comments. The first would be that, as she mentioned, history is usually written by the victors. In this case, it appears that the defeated in the South, after Reconstruction ended in 1877, after the election of 1876 and the resolution of that, and when the white supremacists, I guess for the lack of a better term, took over in the South from then on through the end of the 19th century into the 20th, those defeated became the new victors, as you will, in post Reconstruction. Therefore, they wrote the history that's been suppressed that this guest has so eloquently uncovered. My other comment is this: Eric Foner, F-O-N-E-R, is also a scholar who writes along a similar vein on more from the legal history perspective. I'm wondering if your guest might relate how her work sort of intertwines, complements, contrasts with Professor Foner's work, or about the victor and defeated comment I had. Thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you, David. And Victoria?
Yes. Well, Eric Foner, his work on the origins of the Free Soil Movement was one of the most influential books that I read as a graduate student, and I'm certainly happy to have my work compared with his. Yes, I do think that what we see in the post-Reconstruction period is that the defeated class, the Confederacy, really makes a stunning comeback under the banner of white supremacy and a total denigration of the Republican Party, of a blaming of simply just about everything you could think of on the Republican Party and the battles between the third party movements that come about during that period of time and the Democratic, the revitalized white supremacist Democratic Party of that era, are really what I emphasize in the Long Shadow of the Civil War as being a battle over what the South might have been and what the South became. And there really is an element of tragedy there in the coming of segregation. And also the economic situation where you have a very wealthy class and you have a great deal of poverty among whites, but you also have the successful turning of whites against blacks and, you know, something that's all too typical, something that we still see today where people are fighting over the crumbs and not really looking beyond their own neighborhood to really understand how the economic system and the political structure have dovetailed to create the world, a very difficult world that emerges in the South in the wake of the Civil War, especially after Reconstruction.
I imagine historians up late at a party might have fun speculating on what might have been. Do you see an alternate life for the South, the way things could have gone differently?
Well, I do. I mean, I think, it's There are so many crucial battles that are fought and lost for the average white Southerner, that are lost for obviously African Americans. I mean, the turning back of the 14th and 15th Amendments to all intents and purposes, and the economic structure that that does not really lend itself to widespread land ownership, prosperity. The whole reasons why you have these third-party movements. If the third-party movements had succeeded, it's something we could stay up all night discussing what might have been if the Populist Party had managed to become a mainstream party, for example. I think definitely we would have seen it. We could have seen a different South. The issue of race was always a difficult one. There aren't a whole lot of hopeful moments to look at in terms of race relations after the Civil War. But then again, white supremacy became such a political tactic, such a way to divide people along class lines, that even race relations, we can imagine, might have been better had there not been this horrific battle between haves and have-nots and those who struggled to keep it that way, to keep it the way it was.
Hmm. Or maybe that can be your next book. So much ground there that's fascinating to talk about.
Yes.
Let's take our next call now. We have Mark with us from Brussels. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'd like to follow up on what you and your comments. I would imagine after the war, during Reconstruction, some of these Southern Unionists would have been in a unique position to the Republican Party would have recognized them and given them some leg up in terms of Reconstruction. And if they were, why did they? I guess you've already just mentioned that, but just flesh out. Why did they? What were the battles that caused them to fail? You would think that they would have the inside track on things in the Reconstruction.
Hmm. A very good point, and in fact, the Unionists in Jones County, as well as in many other areas, they were given political appointments by the Republican Party after the war. Newt Knight had several appointments, and so did several of the other men who were part of the Knight Company. But then we have to look at the concerted effort by the old leadership class coming back into power, and they were able to successfully do that. For example, we have two Republican governors, William Woods Holden in North Carolina and Adelbert Ames in Mississippi, both of them impeached, driven out of power. And Adelbert Ames was probably he was the person who gave Newt Knight several of his appointments. But nationally speaking, the old class was not really a defeated class. I mean, they still had the lion's share of economic power. And I think we also have to look at the North and recognize that that the Northern branch of the Republican Party also did not play nearly as large a role as it could have in trying to reinforce the power of these former Unionists down in throughout the South. You have much more of an emphasis on economic development, on industrialization, on moving the West, building railroads, that sort of thing. And the whole effort of the North and the South to effect reconciliation, that the whole thing of let's bring the nation back together, involved in many cases sacrificing these leaders at local levels in not prosecuting the Ku Klux Klan, for example, the role of the Ku Klux Klan in driving Republicans out of communities. I mean, I have a chapter on North Carolina, on Orange County, North Carolina, where there probably is no more horrific story of the Klan's terrorization of Republicans than in Orange County. But it's repeated throughout areas of the South. And so the war continued. It continued on a different basis, but it certainly continued long after the war was over.
And wasn't it Newt Knight who also kept petitioning the federal government to provide some kind of compensation to his band of followers, and he just never got anywhere?
That's right. And that's very indicative of the fact that the North was really not at all eager to compensate, to reward the Southern Unionists. And as time went on and as this reconciliation took place before the North and the South, they were even less inclined to believe it. And particularly then you get the economic forces, depression in the 1890s. And you've got Newt Knight petitioning for 30 years, from 1870 to 1900. He fought to get compensation, not just for himself, but for 54 other members of the Knight Company. He wanted them all to be paid a certain amount of soldiers' wages as an ad hoc band that had served the Union. But, yeah, the sympathy declined rather rapidly. And there was – I think you see Northerners also buying into the myth of the lost cause, the myth of a solid South. It was very difficult for them to believe that white Southerners weren't simply trying to just get some money from the government, but that they had actually fought for the Union there in their hometowns. And that's what led Newt Knight to that saying that I quoted earlier, that he sort of dismissed the government after 30 years of not getting a dime from them. And that's when he began to believe that the non-slaveholders should have just risen up and revolutionized, basically.
Do you think that position by the North and the federal government not to compensate these people was a mistake, given the hatred or the white supremacy that unfolded in the South?
I'm not sure I understand your question. I mean,
do you think that they should have been more supportive of these people? Did that have anything to do with the white supremacy that rose later on?
I'm not sure if they're what I would. I mean, the two are sort of parallel events. I think that you see white unionists being seen as. As no better than blacks. I mean, white supremacy goes after white supremacists go after Southern Unionists the same way they do black Republicans. They see them in an unholy alliance. They see it as degrading for Southern whites to be part of a Republican Party that they see as, you know, black Republicanism. So in that sense, the two are always linked to one another, Southern white unionists with this white supremacist campaign. And if I'm understanding you right, I would say yes, if the North had supported Southern Unionists more, it would have hopefully strengthened their own hand in planting and in strengthening the Republican Party in the South. They sort of let their own or a large part of their own Southern constituency just go down the drain. Now, they did fund some Southern Unionists. I'm not saying none of them got money, but the vast majority of Southern Unionists were not compensated.
Our guest this hour is Victoria Bynum. She's the author of The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Descent and Its Legacies. And we're looking forward to hearing from more of you this morning. How does Southern Unionism change the way we know the Civil War story, do you think? And why haven't we heard more about it? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. You can also follow along on Facebook. You'll find a link at wpr.org. And coming up at 10 o'clock, it's an NPR News special, live coverage of the final launch of the space shuttle as Atlantis makes one more supply run to the International Space Station. Join Neil Conan for this momentous event as NASA's program prepares for its last liftoff. And NPR and WPR will be taking you there coming up at 10 o'clock on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can find your station or listen online at WPR.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today, a look at the science behind the perfect porterhouse steak. And again, at 10 o'clock, Wisconsin Public Radio will be going live to NPR coverage of the final flight for the space shuttle Atlantis. That's coming up in less than 15 minutes here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking with Victoria Bynum. She's the author of The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Descent and Its Legacies. Going back to the phone lines now, we have with us Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you. I wonder if the guest could talk a little bit about the actual border states, specifically like Illinois, Indiana, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Because I remember when I was a kid, I remember learning that in southern Illinois and Indiana, you had people on both sides of the war. I mean, there'd be plenty of Unionists and also Confederates mm-hmm. in Illinois and Indiana. And I just wonder how true that is.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah. Victoria?
Yeah, that's a good question. While that hasn't been my area of primary research, I'm certainly familiar with that topic, and I happen to live in Missouri today, which was one of those states as well that had its inner civil war, and there you have states that go with the Union, yet they have their Confederate sympathizers. And it's very, very real. And one of the reasons, of course, is that you had so many Southerners that moved into Missouri and Illinois and Indiana that there's a lot of just regional loyalty, and there's also plenty of support for slavery. Still by people who nevertheless might live in non-slaveholding states. But the whole – all of the issues that made one either support the Confederacy or support the Union are so influenced by kinship. That's one thing that I really emphasize in The Long Shadow of the Civil War, kinship, cultural loyalties, regional loyalties. And then political, of course, they become very political. But all of those states, as Sarah points out, had their own divisions and had, if not inner civil wars, well, Tennessee certainly had inner civil wars, and so did Missouri. But they had their violent conflicts as well. And those are the factors that I would cite as most important, the ones that I've just mentioned.
Well, thank you for the call, and we go next to Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hello. The war didn't end in 1865 because there would be battles long through in Reconstruction. And, there were Southerners who supported Union. You had West Virginia. You had the Vice President of the United States who ran with Lincoln in 1864. Johnson was from Tennessee. He didn't run on the Republican Party, neither did Lincoln in that year. They ran on the Unionist Party. The Democratic Party in the North was in many ways a little different from that in the South. And their campaign song of, let's say, 1872, as I recall, was "We Are the White Man's Party." It was not only in the South that you had these views. You had draft riots in New York City where New Yorkers burned a black orphanage, and it was an anti-black riot. Many of the northern whites felt they were fighting on behalf of blacks who would be job competitors. The point you're making, yes, there were Southern whites who opposed secession. And if you look at election maps by county from the 1860s up until the 1960s, you will find many counties in Carolinas, in Tennessee, even one or two in Alabama, even a parish in Louisiana who consistently voted Republican.
And thank you for that call, Hugh. And a lot to chew on there, Victoria. Do you want to respond?
Yes. Well, I would like to just thank Hugh for pointing out that white supremacy was never, ever confined to the South. And like him, I have been just struck by some of the campaign slogans of the Northern Democratic Party as it built this white supremacy campaign. And, of course, he's absolutely right. The draft riots and the Irish draft riots, the opposition to fighting a war that would free slaves and have them coming up north, and many feared taking northern jobs. I mean, all of this reality of racism that so permeated a nation that had been a slaveholding nation for many years and that countenanced slavery for many years, it has to be emphasized and recognized. We didn't have a North of that believed in racial equality and a South that didn't. It's so much more complex than that. And understanding the racism of the North helps us to understand and to answer that question of an earlier caller who asked, why were the Unionists not able to, or the Republicans able to keep power in the South? Oftentimes the racial issues were divisive nationwide, not just simply a North-South issue. So I would certainly agree with that. And there were important unionists, as Hugh points out as well, throughout the South, leaders. And the only one I would add to his list, or one that I would add to the list, would be Sam Houston, Governor Sam Houston of Texas, also opposed secession. So he makes some very good points there.
Well, thank you for the call, Hugh. And we move to Jillian in Appleton. Hi there.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you for this excellent discussion. I'm not someone who's particularly schooled in the Civil War, but this is the type of a discussion that would get anybody more interested in history, because we realize how much more complex the situation was and how much more interesting the people were than we're often told in history books in school. And it reminds me of the book by James Lowen, a couple of books by James Lowen, one called Lies My Teacher Told Me. And I was reminded of this particular by the last caller who was talking about how widespread white supremacy was. I mean, his book has two chapters on how basically high school textbooks don't really discuss racism or the fight against it. Very fascinating author for general public. I was also struck, as several other callers were, by how relevant this is to us today. If we can just notice how there's a lot of diversity within the South, which as a northerner we, you know, think they're all bad people who want slaves. And when we look at another country, we tend to vastly oversimplify who's there. When we look at our own country, I certainly agree with a number of people who mentioned how what's going on in Wisconsin and actually nationwide is very much reflected by the small, powerful minority, a very small people whose interest really is at stake, but they have so much power and in the media. But my final question really would be about, I think I first became aware of some of this from the film Cold Mountain, which I found absolutely riveting and haunting with its portrayal of how these women were fighting their own wars there, not necessarily because they were unionists, but because just because of what was going on and the vigilante nature of that home guard, which was mentioned in the discussion a while ago. Can your guest comment on whether that film and book are really as historically accurate as they felt to me?
Great. Well, thank you, Jillian, and thank you for the kind words, too. I appreciate it. Victoria?
Yes, thank you very much, and I really appreciate your recognition that we have a much more complex South and North to look at here that is just fascinating. And Cold Mountain is, in fact, the location of Cold Mountain is precisely, my understanding is pretty much it overlaps with the Quaker Belt of North Carolina that I include a few chapters on, especially that chapter about the women that we talked about earlier, the women's uprisings against Confederate abuse and conscription of their sons and their husbands. So Cold Mountain is a fictionalized version of a story that's very, very real. And the only – I would say in the movie, which is very, very well done – there could have been even more on the actual political ideologies and the fierceness of the inner Civil War. But I think that Cold Mountain is a wonderful example of how we begin to bring more understanding of the complexities of the war and of the South in general to a general public. So I'm glad you mentioned that. A very good example of how that can be done.
Well, Jillian, thank you again for the call. And for our last caller this hour, let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Yes, thank you very much for this hour. I grew up in the South. You know, you probably can't tell from my accent anymore.
Not so much, no.
Hard to get rid of it. I grew up in Louisiana. And the emotions down there were very divided even when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s. about, you know, the South, you know, whether it was a lost cause or whether it was they were a bunch of rebels rightly put in their place or whatever. What I'd like to know about is what does the guest think about the current neo-secessionist movements in the South that are cropping up all over the place, especially there's some fairly loud ones in Alabama and Mississippi that basically see the United States as occupying their land, and they're calling for a new secessionist movement.
And Bill, I'm going to cut you off there because we have about 40 seconds for Victoria's response.
Yes, I'm very aware of that as well. And having lived in Texas until recently, you know, Rick Perry, who's now talking about running for president, is one of those who talked about secession being a course that Southern states might take. The neo-secession or neo-Confederate movement, as I'm more familiar with it being called, is very, very real. And I think in many ways it reflects the fact that a more complex story is making it to the surface, and it's a reaction against it. And it's very connected to the politics of today, as several people have mentioned. We're taking old arguments and updating them, just as the Confederate flag in the 1950s came to be the flag of segregation.
Oh, Victoria Bynum, it's been such a rich hour. Thank you so much for sharing your book with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. And thanks to all the people who called in. Wonderful questions and comments.
I agree. Well, we've been talking this hour with Victoria Bynum, the author of The Long Shadow of the Civil War, Southern Descent and Its Legacies. Victoria has taught at Texas State University in San Marcos, and she's also the author of The Free State of Jones. Thanks to Joe Hartke for technical direction, to Rhonda Fanning and Erica Janik for production. And don't forget, coming up in about 20 seconds, we go live to special NPR news coverage of the final launch of the space shuttle Atlantis as it makes one more supply run to the International Space Station. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.